the final argument this morning is Ruth Williams versus Ruben Wallace. For the appellant is Thomas Tobin, attorney from Aberdeen, and for the appellee would be William Fuller, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself from this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable John Erickson from here on, the circuit judge in the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabres' place. Mr. Tobin, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justice of the Supreme Court. I don't know if this is a first or not, but I understand that my son argued right before me. This could be the first time that a father-son argued back-to-back in arguments to the court. But
well, we were wondering if it was going to be against each other. But
I'm here today to represent Ruth Williams as her individually and as the personal representative of the estate of her deceased husband, Jim. This is a legal malpractice case that arose out of a long history with the parties involved. Jim and Ruth were married, and Eldon and Mary were married, and Mary and Ruth are sisters, and Eldon and Jim are brothers. And they came back and farmed with the Williams farmstead back in Tripp County in winter. And at this time, they farmed together for a long number of years. One significant fact is that in the past, I think in 1984, the parties used Mr. Wallace to have him prepare a buy-sell agreement that was kind of like a partnership buy-sell agreement, and it was only signed by the men. It was only signed by Jim, and it was only signed by Eldon. The wives did not sign, nor did it appear that they participated in the agreement whatsoever. It did deal with several pieces of property, and it did deal with the future, and it was also several ways of terminating the partnership that they had at that time. It appeared that Mr. Mollis had represented both parties, both sets of families, for quite some time, and that Ruth and Jim used him during the years. However, it was apparent that Jim was the primary person that took care of the legal affairs, and Ruth was a person that had faith and trust in her husband and Ruben and allowed them to take care of those affairs. Unexpectedly, on February 14, 1995, Jim dies, and Ruth contacts Mr. Mollis to represent her in the estate and also individually. I don't think there was any argument in the fact that it was kind of a dual representation. At the time of the handling of the estate, there was a reading of the will, so to speak, and the parties were there, meaning Ruth was there, Ruth's children were there, and Eldon and Mary were there. And Ruth's son took notes during the meeting regarding what was discussed and what may come up in the future. And that was introduced as an exhibit in the deposition of Ruth. And in that meeting, it was specifically talked about conflict of interest, who was representing who, and Ruben made it quite clear that he was representing Ruth, that was his client, and that he was representing her and going to handle the estate for Ruth, and that he did anticipate that there could be a conflict, but he said if there was no conflict, he could represent all the parties. If there was a conflict, he could not. Also during that meeting, there was a note that said long term, and it said that nothing could be done until the estate was settled, and then I think it said something like estate would be planned after that fact, so the estate had to be over with before they were going to go any further. Shortly after the death, the probate was started, and the next significant fact would come up sometime in early December or right around November sometime, when a contract for deed was prepared. The contract for deed was between the estate and Ruth individually and between Eldon and Mary. And basically what this contract for deed did was dispose of all the assets of Mary that was the subject matter of the farming operation to Eldon and Mary by virtue of a contract for deed. The parties were under the assumption, I think, that the buy-sell agreement was controlling on their actions after the death of Jim. And from that basis, most of the other types of activities flowed. the parties went ahead and felt like they had to do something. I think Eldon and Mary were probably behind most of it. But in any event, it was a time that Ruth was very distraught, very confused, and she testified to that. In fact, she testified to that. She didn't even remember signing the contract for deed or any of the events that led up to it, that she did sign it. She didn't argue that it wasn't her signature on it. It just showed the state of mind that she was vulnerable and needed help. After that point in time, some period of time goes on, and the contract for deed actually is implemented, meaning that the property is transferred or the contract for deed is honored. Payments are made by Eldon and Mary to Ruth. About in August of, Jim died in 1995, and in August of 1997, things had not progressed very far after the contract for deed. And Ruth testified in her deposition that it didn't appear that she was getting responses or getting things back from Reuben. And didn't think that she had gotten all her papers back that she needed or that her inquiry was being honored. She did contact a lawyer, Mitchell, James Taylor and Mitchell, in it appears to be about August of 1997. The letter from Taylor to Mollis is dated August 13, 1997. This lawsuit was served upon Mr. Mollis on August 16, 2000. And that becomes the real crux of the issue that brings us here. The trial court only reached the issue of the summary judgment based upon the statute of limitations. He did not go any further than that because he felt that was disposed of the issue and that was the end of the case. But that's the only basis for his ruling was the issue of statute of limitations. The trial court also assumed that the basic failure of the attorney in this relationship was the contract for deed that was prepared in November, December of 1995. And so the original threshold of the statute of limitations would have been 3 years from that date, which would be 1998. And as I said before, the lawsuit was not filed until, or served upon Mr. Mollis until August 16th of 2000. The trial court also went on to see if there was a tolling of the statute in this case, and that's, again, the real crux of why we're here, is that it is the position of Ruth Williams that the statute was tolled because of the ongoing and continuous relationship that she had with Mr. Mollis. It is significant to note that she had no other lawyer at any time in her life until she went to see Mr. Taylor. At no time did Mr. Mollis ever indicate a conflict of interest or indicate to her that she should go seek independent counsel, and then she ignored his advice, or at no time did Mr. Mollis declare a conflict of interest that would have triggered her reasoning to go find additional counsel. The significance is that it is the plaintiff's contention that by failure to give her proper advice throughout the entire probate proceeding and the entire time, that she was not able to exercise her individual rights or exercise rights on behalf of the estate that could have been exercised that would have increased the value of the estate and could have increased in her portion, or it would have changed what was available for sale in the contract for deed. And that is an ongoing relationship that did not terminate. Now, at the best, Mr. Mollis could claim that his relationship with Ruth terminated in December of 1997 because it wasn't until then that he actually filed the final decree. And although the defendant, it seems to indicate that's just a minor act, the filing of the final decree and the final order of distribution actually determines the property rights of the parties and who has the property and who would be legally able to sell or dispose of the property or transfer the property or own the property.
And if that is then taken into account, that gets you within the statute of limitations.
That's correct. That's correct. And the contacting of another lawyer in and of itself isn't going to interrupt that continuous relationship that Ruth would have had. The August 13th letter merely asked for information. And one of the prime reasons for asking for their information was to plan her estate. And that was something that was going to take place after the completion of the probate in any event, because that's what was said at the very beginning of this case.
That's all a disputed issue of fact, isn't it?
Yes. That is a disputed issue of fact. But I think it's an important disputed issue of fact, because if it's true, then it would indicate that there was an intent of the parties to have this continuing relationship throughout the entire time of the probate, and that there was to be an ongoing relationship even after the probate that would not only advise her of the extent of her assets and give her financial advice, but was also going to provide additional planning for her estate when she died.
And the estate was closed in January of 1998, and it was Mr. Mollis who did that?
The amendment to the estate was made at that time, Your Honor. The original order holding was in December, but there was an amended order that was filed in 1998. But it was the intention of the parties that this personal relationship would exist throughout the entire probate proceedings, that she would get advice independently and as personal representative, and her estate planning would take place after the probate was entirely completed. We believe that this is an ongoing relationship. It's a continuous relationship. And that the handling of the probate and the establishment of legal rights and land and property and money accounts and these types of things are not minor acts. They are important acts. It's a culmination of all the work. It's the court order that passes on the property and determines the legal ownership and the legal rights of the parties involved in the estate. And so it's not merely something that just happens to have to be filed like a certificate of service, so to speak. This is a complete accounting or document outlining the estate and who is entitled to its property. For instance, in the estate, in the original, the inventory, and in the final accounting, the land was treated as joint tenancy property. If in fact that's true, Ruth Williams did not have anything to sell on behalf of the estate as far as land, because she owned it all. She would have owned it all at the time of death. And she would have got that legal title at the time of the final order being entered. That was 2 years later.
Well, I thought in a joint tenancy, it vested upon death, subject only to expenses of administration.
And I agree with that. And I think that is the correct law. And my point only was being that the title company probably wouldn't pass on it until the final order was entered. But you're absolutely right. The vesting occurs at the time of death. And so, consequently, that land was Ruth Williams' land at the time of death. Now, she had no intention of selling it other than the fact that she felt that she was bound by the buy-sell agreement. And the buy-sell agreement was not signed by her. Also, there are provisions in the buy-sell agreement that did not take place to trigger certain events. For instance, if the death of a partner event was to be to take place, which happened in this case, then the surviving partner was supposed to give notice of his intent to invoke the buy-sell agreement within a certain period of time. No such notice was given. If in fact that's true, then the buy-sell agreement should be null and void, and Ruth Williams can go ahead and proceed to own the land and own her share of the property independent of the buy-sell agreement. And if she wishes, she could easily sell it at marketplace. She's not tied to a particular person or a particular agreement or a time frame. Or if she could have remained a partner. She could have remained a partner. And she could have stayed there and managed her assets along with Eldon and Mary and received the fruits of that labor and that investment over a period of time. None of that happened because she wasn't given the correct advice at the time and given that opportunity to make those types of decisions. There is no dispute that nothing was brought up about this. The only thing that happened was that the contract for deed was signed in December of 1995. And the parties went ahead and became bound by it. Ruth has also denied the opportunity, upon discovering these things, that she could have made a rescission of the contract. Even if she was signed the contract, and if there's any legal validity to it, she could have easily rescinded the contract and used three different theories that I know of. One would be mutual mistake of fact, one would be unilateral mistake of fact, one would be constructive trust. And all of those would have created a new event that would have given her an increase in the economic advantage that she was deserving of, not only herself, but also inside of the estate. Both parties here have been harmed because of the rush to the contract for deed and the cloistering of the parties that were involved in this case to produce a particular result. The legal standard on the continuous relationship is certainly as fact as it can get. It involves a lot of different scenarios, it involves a lot of different assumptions or expectations, but there's no doubt that we had an attorney-client relationship here. It's never been disputed. Never been disputed that she was told that Ruben was her lawyer and the estate's lawyer, and that if there ever was a conflict of interest, he would tell them that he couldn't represent both sides at that point in time. None of that ever happened. But it was ongoing, it was developing, things were happening inside the estate, and the last thing that was going to happen was the vesting of the ownership of the land was going to take place, and it was going to take place by virtue of the probate being completed. Is there any significance to the hiring of James Taylor that would toll the relationship? Not in this case. There have been other cases that where maybe the hiring of a lawyer was a substitute and it did intervene and no longer toll the statute. But in this case, all we have on the record is an inquiry as of August 13th to get information from Mr. Mollis. Why was he contacting Mr. Wallace on August 13th? Because he was Ruth's lawyer. He was Ruth's lawyer. He was obtaining information for her personally because he was Ruth's personal lawyer. And that information was created at some point in time after that time, and it was after that time that the relationship between Mr. Wallace and Ruth may have terminated upon his completion of the probate. But it wasn't until that time. Everything in this probate and the partnership and buy-sell and the contract for deed and the individual rights are intertwined. You can't separate them in this particular case. You could have if people had independent counsel, but in this case they're all intertwined and the defendant should not be able to come now and say, well, I only had a ministerial act to do, or I did not have anything to do with her for a year and a half or so, when in fact her testimony says that I wasn't getting responses from Winter, and that's why I went to Mitchell. I didn't think I got all my paperwork back. I didn't think I was getting what I wanted. So the expectation of the client that she was being represented all this time certainly was there.
If we reverse this, would we have to determine that the trial court was clearly erroneous in a finding of fact?
No. In fact, the clearly erroneous standard does not apply in these summary judgment cases. The standard is that this court, this Supreme Court, has the right to independently scrutinize the entire record to see if there is any genuine material issue of fact to determine the case.
So are you saying there is a genuine issue of material fact?
Yes. If you look at the continuous representation rule, that's all facts laced all the way through. If you look at the time frame as to the significance of Mr. Taylor's representation and the closeness to that of August 13th as far as the initial inquiry and the filing of the probate final order in December of the same year, if you go 3 years from that, you're right in the mix of things. You're right there. And a jury should decide whether or not there was that continuous relationship that met the standards of court cases that would then give rise to this cause of action in the total.
And that's not a conclusion of law.
It isn't in this case, you know, because it's too fact-based. I don't think that the law was applied other than to conclude that there were no disputed facts. I think that's what the court said, the judge said, was that there was no ongoing relationship. He went right down the line. He said there was no ongoing and it wasn't being developed and all this type of stuff. Well, in fact, it was, because Was it by coincidence that the letter by Mr. Taylor asked me for information in August, and then all of a sudden it was closed in December? And if in fact it was just ministerial and it was nothing to do but just to do it, August to December? I mean, that's 4 months. Obviously, there was more work to be done. It had to be more preparation and preparing the final order in the accounting than just walking into the courthouse and filing. And at all times, Ruth testified several times in deposition. I trusted him. I had nobody else to count on. He had been a longtime friend. My husband went to high school with him. He was my lawyer. He said he'd go to God after me. Several references in her deposition to that. And we believe that that is why the circuit court ought to be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Mr. Fuller, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Bill Fuller, and it's my privilege to represent Reuben Mollis in this matter. I wanted to pick up where Mr. Tobin left off, and that is that when Jim Taylor entered the picture in August of 1997, at that point in time, it was clear, and it's beyond dispute, that there was no longer a developing, dependent relationship between Reuben Mollis and Mr. Tobin's client, Ruth Williams. Ruth Williams actually testifies in a deposition on page 40 that the probate was closed by Mr. Taylor. It was never closed by Mr. Mollis. And then she stated again on page 56 in her deposition, we took it to Jim Taylor and Mitchell to do the probate. So actually the first contact as shown in the record, I believe, was a fax from Jim Taylor to Reuben Mollis for an authorization releasing his file to Jim Taylor, which I believe was August 7th of 1997, which was followed up by a letter on August 13, 1997.
And this was for the estate? Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is the reason she went to Jim Taylor was to complete the estate. And so,
was there anything in the court files ever replacing one lawyer withdrawing and another one replacing?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Nor was there any correspondence other than Taylor's letter?
In the court file, I don't think there is, Your Honor. It's my understanding, and Mr. Tobin can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Mr. Mollis completed the final inventory that was submitted to the court and was accepted by the court, I believe, in January of 1998. But my point, Your Honor, is it was in August of 1997, and it's clear beyond dispute that there was no longer a dependent relationship on Reuben Mollis or a developing, continuing relationship on Reuben Mollis.
Well, who files the final decree then, Taylor or Mollis?
I believe it's Mollis, Your Honor.
Does it actually require a dependent relationship? I thought it was simply a matter of continuing involvement in either the same or a related transaction.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, through a series of cases, starting with Schoenrock through versus Tappy and Green versus Morgan Thieler, that it must be an ongoing, developing, independent relationship. It must also, the services rendered by the attorney must be related to the initial subject matter, which is the subject matter of the alleged malpractice. And in this case, Your Honor, the alleged malpractice was the negotiation of the contract for deed, which occurred back in December of 1995. Actually, the contract for deed was signed December 27, 1995. Her complaint against Reuben Mollis, and I'm taking her side of the story, which probably is the right way to do it with a summary judgment, but her complaint against Reuben Mollis is that he somehow did not negotiate properly the contract for deed, and so she ended up with a contract for deed where the property was appraised too low and the interest payment to her was too low, and there was a prepayment clause in the contract for deed which she is now claiming should not have been in there. That's the nuts and bolts of her claim against Reuben Mollis. And this was all consummated, completed, finished when that contract for deed was signed on December 27, 1995. This action for malpractice was started August 8, 2000.
But it's arguable that that contract for deed was part of the closing up of the estate, isn't it?
It's arguable, Your Honor, but I don't think that's correct for the reason that the closing of the estate essentially was merely filing the inventory and having the judge sign the final distribution. When that contract for deed was signed in December of 1995, bear in mind, by the time the estate was closed, I think three annual payments of $15,000 apiece had already been made on the contract.
The fact that it was kept open for another 2 or 3 years, that wasn't necessarily Mrs. Williams' fault. Mr. Mollis could have closed it any time after that, couldn't he?
I agree with you, Your Honor, but I don't think that's the determining issue here or determining fact. I think the point and the issue is that the malpractice, the alleged malpractice, occurred on December 27, 1995, when that contract for deed was signed, and at that point, it was irremedial. The contract was signed. I suppose, theoretically, somebody at a later date, the plaintiff or her children, could sue for some type of rescission or some type of remedy with the court, but that's always the case. I mean, that remedy is always out there. In this case, when we're talking about a statute of limitations, this court has stated in cases such as Green versus Morgan Thieler, when they were talking about signing a prenuptial agreement, the cause of action accrued when that agreement was signed. In Haber versus Rice, the cause of action accrued when the deed was conveyed to the buyer and they didn't get the money. That's when the cause of action accrued. That's when the statute begins to run. What is silent in the record, or what is absent in the record, is any continuing representation relating to that contract for deed. The reason there isn't anything is because there was nothing further to be done or could be done. The contract was entered into, it was signed, the money was exchanged, and I think three payments actually were made before the final decree of distribution. So the cause of action is consummated, it accrues, the statute starts running on December 27, 1995. Nothing happens beyond that point in time related to that transaction.
So under that theory, then, it really doesn't matter whether or not she sought advice from Taylor.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's correct. But beyond that, and I think Judge Rohr focused on the additional or supplemental representation by James Taylor, which is beyond dispute. And according to her testimony, Ruth Williams' testimony, she went to Jim Taylor to do the probate.
Well, but the letters say otherwise, don't they? The letter says it's for her own estate planning purposes now that her husband has died.
That's what the letters say. You're right, Your Honor. But even so, that, in my mind, represents a new relationship. She is no longer dependent on Reuben Mollis for any type of guidance or advice.
But Reuben went on to close up the estate.
I think probably, and I'm not sure whether this is in the record or not, and so I'm a little hesitant to state it, but I think perhaps there was some prompting on the part of Mr. Taylor, but I don't know whether that's in the record or not.
But still, no, Mr. Mollis wasn't fired. He wasn't told to turn over the file so that Mr. Taylor could close it, and he, in fact, closed it, didn't he?
Correct. You're right, Your Honor.
We don't know in the course of managing and assembling the assets and doing all that, without the file in front of us or without reviewing all of this, we don't know what Mollis did in that two and a half year period, do we? Or what was needed to be done.
You're correct, Your Honor. I don't think there was anything in this record that would demonstrate what needed to be done. Frankly, I don't think there was much that needed to be done. I think what was simply holding up at least partially the estate was just correspondence from the IRS concerning the tax consequences. I don't think that explains the long period of delay, but that explains part of the delay. The point is, the delay is not the malpractice. That's not the claim for the malpractice. The claim for the malpractice is that she got a bad deal when she signed that contract for deed. That's the claim for the malpractice. And it's simple and it's right that the malpractice, alleged malpractice, consummated, completed as of December 27, 1995. The continuing representation doctrine requires, and this court has spoken in reference to the continuing representation doctrine in several cases. Green versus Morgan Thieler is one in which Jack Thieler prepared the prenuptial agreement, which provided for the waiver of alimony. And the statute of limitations was raised in that case and addressed by this court. And in that case, this court stated that the continuous representation doctrine did not apply, even though Green, the client plaintiff, came in to see Thieler for estate planning, which is kind of what we're talking about here with Jim Taylor. And the claim by Green was that the estate planning encompassed the effect of the prenuptial agreement. You couldn't do the estate planning without looking at the validity and the effect of the prenuptial agreement. And this court said that that's too tangential. That's too far removed from the substance of the claimed malpractice. And therefore, the continuous representation doctrine did not apply. There have been other cases, Curlis versus Bradsky, also coming from this court, in which the plaintiff, Curlis, went to another firm concerning representation on the sale of a motel, I believe it was Costello Porter. Well, after he went to Costello Porter, there was continued communications between Bradsky and Curlis, and this court again said that there was not shown to be any direct relationship with the alleged malpractice, and the continuous representation doctrine did not apply. I've cited Kindle versus Morissette, which is an Eighth Circuit case, but it comes from South Dakota. And again, the Eighth Circuit, in applying South Dakota law, said that the continuous representation doctrine did not apply, even though the firm did closing papers and sent a letter to the client giving them a status report after the lawsuit was dismissed, which is analogous to our situation with the final decree and distribution. So in all of those cases, this court and the Eighth Circuit has said that in order for the continuing representation doctrine to apply, it must be an ongoing relationship, and it also must be a developing and dependent relationship. And it must be related to the services provided, which is the alleged malpractice. The services provided by Reuben Mollis after December 27, 1995 had no direct relationship on negotiating the contract for deed or the deal that she got under the contract for deed. Certainly by August of 1997, when Jim Taylor is in the picture, it is not a developing, dependent relationship. And by the precepts of this court and other courts, the continuous representation doctrine simply has no application.
What about the phrase same or related services? What effect does that have on this?
Your Honor, I don't think it has any effect, because the same services or related services dealt with negotiating the terms on the contract for deed. That's her claim. And anything beyond that period of time, the final decree and distribution, has nothing to do with negotiating the terms and getting a better deal under the contract for deed. So it fails because it's not a related service, and it fails because it's not an ongoing, dependent, developing relationship. It wasn't developing, it was dying. It was almost dead at that point in time by the time she went to Jim Taylor. She wasn't happy with Reuben Mollis, and that's why she went to another lawyer. Your Honor, I have about 6 minutes left, and I wanted to briefly talk about the issues that we raised on the notice of review.
Before you start into that, or maybe as a premise to that, would you tell me what is the status of the record on that damage issue? Did you make a motion for summary judgment?
Correct.
And was that record fully developed? I mean, responsive affidavits and the typical response and all that was done? It was all before Judge Rohr?
It was before Judge Rohr, Your Honor.
But
yes.
A fully developed summary judgment record was there?
Yes, it was. It was fully developed. I mean, when you say fully developed, of course, the record, our argument on the issue of damage was that there's no proof of damage. And so the record was fully developed in that we asserted, which is beyond dispute, that there was no proof of monetary damage. And that was part of our motion, the basis, one of our bases for our motion for summary judgment.
Let me ask it another way. Was there any request for more time for discovery on the issue of damages, or an argument to the effect that the plaintiffs hadn't had time to prepare that part of their case?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. I don't believe there was.
And did they rely solely on the Larson deposition?
Pardon me?
Did they rely solely on the Larson deposition?
Well,
is that the only basis for their damage?
The Larson deposition was dealing with the standard of care, and Larson did not testify to any damage, and he was not retained for that purpose, Your Honor.
I understand that, but I mean, is that the only evidence in the record that there is a damage? Did they file an affidavit saying, no, these are our damages? Or?
To answer your question, Mr. Larson did not testify to any damage, and there was no affidavit that I can recall specifying the amount of damage, just that she got a bad deal. I asked her in her deposition what she thought the value of the land should be. She said she didn't know. No expert was retained or presented any evidence that the land was worth more than what it was, probably because there was no expert that would so testify. Randy Stenson was an appraiser that was well respected in the Winter area, and she agreed with Eldon Williams that they should use Randy Stenson. And after Stenson issued his appraisal, she knew and she testified that she had the option to go to another appraiser, and she chose not to do it. And her response was, I don't know why I didn't do it, but we didn't do it. And so, Your Honor, that there is no evidence of damage. We have Randy Stenson's appraisal, his affidavit, in which he rendered the appraisal, and nobody told him how to appraise the property, to appraise it high or appraise it low. Just he testified under oath by affidavit he did it the way he was supposed to do it.
Did the trial court indicate why it didn't touch the issue of damages?
I think the trial court, and I was just kind of paging through that to see if I could actually pull it out for you, but I think it was just simply that he didn't think it was necessary. And for that reason, he did not address that issue, Your Honor. I'm reading from Judge Rohr's memorandum decision. The court does not reach the other grounds asserted by Mollis. He just says, Mollis's motion for summary judgment is granted on this grounds, which would be the statute of limitations. And that, in essence, what was stated by Judge Rohr in that regard, Your Honor. But I've cited to the court legal malpractice cases, one of which I'm painfully aware of, Grand State versus Woods Fuller, and also another case, I believe it's Weiss versus Van Norman. And in both those cases, summary judgment was granted because the plaintiff did not present evidence of damage. No damage evidence. Without damage, there can be no viable cause of action for malpractice. And that was the holding in Grand State versus Woods Fuller. That was the basis for the dismissal, which was affirmed by the South Dakota Supreme Court, was that there was no evidence of damage. And a similar holding can be found in Weiss versus Van Norman, in which the South Dakota Supreme Court dealt with a real estate transaction, but the court stated in essence that the commission on the sale was fixed prior to the alleged legal advice, and therefore there was no damage flowing from the alleged legal advice. Here, there is no damage flowing from the alleged legal advice. There is no one from the plaintiff's side that has presented evidence that the land was worth $400 an acre and not $200 an acre, or the deal was should have been this and should have been for this amount, resulting in this amount of damage. And without any damage, there is no viable cause of action for malpractice. For that reason, under the notice of review, beyond the statute of limitations, the summary judgment was appropriate in that the plaintiff failed to present any evidence of damage. And for that reason, the summary judgment should also be affirmed on that basis. My time is up. If the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
Thank you.
Mr. Tobin, you have 10 minutes, sir.
In the Green versus Morgan case, the 1998 South Dakota case, is 1998 South Dakota 16, there was a statement in that case that said, "File, the continuous representation rule has a dual purpose, and that it protects the attorney-client relationship by affording the attorney an opportunity to remedy an error, while also preventing the attorneys from defeating a client's cause of action." That's what we have here. In this time period, Ruth testified that she was contacting him. She didn't get the response she wanted, but she was at least trying to get information or contact Ruben. But in this particular case, he had a duty to correct his error. His error was that he should have informed her that even at whatever stage he wants to pick, she had the right of rescission, or that she had property in her own right, or that she had a contract for deed that was not valid. He had the duty to correct his error, and he either could have chosen to help her or he could have obviously sent her away, but he had a duty to correct his error. You can't let, the attorney just can't let time pass, nor can you ignore your client and then create a non-continuous relationship. There is no way that you can separate the issues in this case between Ruth, Alden, and Mary, or the estate, or Reuben Moss. They're all tied together in the same mind. They're all tied together. You can't separate. You can't say, well, this is this and this is that. The only thing that was to come later was the personal estate planning of Ruth. And that's what Mr. Taylor may have been going to do, but that was the only thing that was to come after the fact. Everything else was ongoing at the same time. But the attorney has the duty to correct the mistake, and that's why in this particular case, he did not afford to himself that opportunity, nor did he give Ruth the opportunity to go ahead and correct the mistakes that were made. The final decree was entered in the probate by Mr. Mollis and dealt with all the property that was in the contract for deed. There isn't a warning of ownership in the property regarding money accounts and land, these types of things. And the reference to the cattle, the machinery, and the assets that were somewhat the partnership assets, it references them that they were owned as tenants in common. And the essence is that, therefore, Ruth would have inherited his half of those assets. And if, in fact, she wasn't bound by the buy-sell agreement, which she certainly wasn't at the time that was being pushed upon her, She could have been a partner. She could have stayed out there at the farm. She could have managed those assets. She could have received the benefit of that investment. Every deviation from the contract for deed, every deviation from the buy-sell agreement that took place in that contract for deed went against Ruth and for Alden and Mary. Every one. She got nothing by virtue of negotiating a contract for deed of whatever assets she may have owned or were going to own in the future.
Does that final decree enforce the terms of the contract for deed, or does it deviate them at all? Or
doesn't even mention it.
Doesn't even say there was one. Doesn't even identify the fact that there's a contract for deed. And the assets of the farm, if you exclude the land, but all the other assets in the farm were dealt with as merely referencing the fact that they're owned as tenants in common. But it doesn't go on to describe who would own them after the death. And doesn't even reference the contract for deed. The contract for deed was clear as to the interest rate that was going to be charged. If there was going to be any future payments or a contract for deed, that interest rate was reduced in favor of Eldon and against Ruth. You know, every one, the value of the cattle, you go right on down the line, every deviation. And it's amazing that the party who was supposed to have the lawyer representing in the case never won an argument in the negotiations in the contract for deed. It was the party who didn't have a lawyer, supposedly, that won every argument in the contract for deed. And it's based upon that that we think that the court was not proper in relying upon a lack of a continuous representation doctrine.
Does that go to her damages then as well?
The damages would result after we are going to be able to go back and explore the case further. The interest rate deviation is in Ruth Williams's affidavit. Her complaining about the value of the land, the fact that she had to negotiate, is in the affidavit. But the interest rate itself and the deviation from the interest rate is in there. But it's our contention that she should have been put back in the place where she had no deal. She isn't bound by the buy-sell agreement. If the land is truly owned in joint tenancy, why doesn't she still own it? And the only reason why she doesn't still own the land is the fact that she deeded it or she sold it because she felt she had to, because she was told she was bound by the contract for deed, excuse me, the buy-sell agreement. And that's why it happened that way. We believe that an act of omission, what doing something that you didn't, not doing something that you should have done, is important, and the omission is just as important as a commission. And in this case, Reuben had a duty to tell Ruth her rights, rights in property, rights as an individual, rights as a personal representative, rights in the estate. And those were never told to her. And you can't now use the fact that I didn't do anything after, I didn't do it in the first place, as a basis for getting out of your obligation. You have a duty, according to our cases, you have a duty to correct your mistakes with your client if that relationship is ongoing. And that duty you can't fail in.
All right, so after the duty issue, then what specifically did you submit to the trial court as evidence of damages?
The evidence would, well, I don't think that
what did you file?
The affidavit of Ruth Williams was filed.
Okay.
And her deposition was used in that. But significantly, the court never ruled on that issue. There was no ruling, there was no basis for a ruling because he ruled that the case was dismissed according to statute of limitations. There wasn't any reaching the issue of damages at all by him. And that's exactly what he said in his opinion.
You haven't filed a rebuttal brief talking about that issue, have you?
No.
And none of that's laid out in writing, is it?
The affidavit of Ruth Williams is laid out in writing as far as what she contended that she should have coming, and the one thing that could be computed is the interest rate, but it appeared that the statute of limitation issue was the only basis for the ruling, and we believe that is the issue that needs to be addressed and reversed by this court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
You can't check that, see if it's...